Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and each week I cover a topic or have an interview designed to prepare members of the armed forces for their civilian career. Today is episode number 133 with Wes Gray.
And I remember in Barwana, in that base camp there, there's this huge like mortar shell that had smashed the side of a wall out, and under it in like red letters said complacency kills. And the idea was, you know, every time you go on a patrol outside the wire, just always remember that the minute you think you won, you're dead. And so we, you know, I just kind of think that's a good attitude to have in business. And we're just lucky and frankly blessed that the number one competitor in our entire industry just is in our backyard. So every single day I'm looking down a bazooka, and I know if we think we won anything, we're going to get destroyed.
Well, there are so many reasons to listen to this episode today. First, finance. Wes was introduced to me by a Wall Street Journal article that my brother-in-law Matt Dankner sent me when he said, basically, check this dude out. You need to try and get a hold of this guy. And I'm still blown away that Wes took the time to speak with me. The Wall Street Journal article talks about how successful he has been in starting and growing his own asset management firm, which is extremely difficult to do. We talk about so much in this episode. We talk about how Wes was in the midst of his PhD and joined the Marines, how that experience has helped him get this far. We talk about why vets are well-suited for fundraising. We talk about how to sell with a passion, how to find a mission that you're excited about. And more than anything else, we talk about the very simple secret of success, which is grind every day and work hard. I think you'll find Wes extremely motivating to hear him talk about his experience and to see how hungry he is 7-8 years in with lots of success behind him, but still getting up early every single day and keeping an eye on the competition. A couple quick admin items. First of all, midway through this episode, I apologize, there's a little bit of distortion in the audio. Power through it. It is very temporary, and it's worth hearing the rest of the episode. Second of all, in the events section at beyonduniform.io, you'll find two events I'm launching in January. I just locked in the date for the Veterans in Consulting online panel. You will not want to miss this. I just locked in the second speaker and hopefully tying up that third speaker soon. We're going to talk about everything you need to know about the field of management consulting, how to get into it, what life is like, what work is like, how to interview, everything you could possibly think about. We're going to do an online video format where you can actually join. You'll see people, they'll see you, you'll be able to ask questions, and it should be a great event. Sign up in the event section if you haven't already. That's going to be the main way that I notify people when that event goes live. Lastly, if you haven't had a chance to give us an iTunes review yet, please do so. Beyond the Uniform on iTunes. 30 seconds of your time helps get the word out. I want to make sure that other veterans have access to these incredible resources and the incredible stories that people have shared on this show. Finally, for real this time, after the episode, there's a little stinger at the end that you're going to want to hear. Wes, I started the recording over again, and Wes talks about an event he's organizing in September of next year called March for the Fallen. New York Times has written about this. I'll have links in the show notes to all the different articles talking about this. It is an incredible event. I plan on being there for this hike, for this march, to honor those who have fallen and who can't join us on that event. It will be an incredible time, and I hope to see many of you listeners there as well. So with that, let's dive in to my interview with Wes Gray. Well, joining me today, just outside of Philadelphia in Broomall, Pennsylvania, is Wes Gray. Wes, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me.
So for listeners, I wanted to give a very brief background on Wes. He is the CEO and the CIO of Alpha Architect, which is a research-intensive asset management firm focused on delivering sophisticated, tax-efficient active exposures at affordable costs, which I'm hoping he will explain to us on the show. He started out at Wharton, where he earned a bachelor's degree in economics, after which he served as a Marine Corps ground intelligence officer for nearly 4 years. After his military service, he earned both his MBA and his PhD from the Chicago Booth School of Business, after which he started Alpha Architect. I was introduced to Wes through a Wall Street Journal article a friend sent me earlier this year, and that Wall Street Journal article started out, quote, "Wesley Gray's value-focused fund of overseas stocks is beating all of its rivals over the past year. For him, it's almost beside the point," end quote. He is also the author of the book Embedded, A Marine Corps Advisor Inside the Iraqi Army. So, Wes, maybe to start out, take us through, you know, how you went from the Marine Corps to starting Alpha Architect.
Sure. So, I probably want to step back a little bit even before that, because my approach in the Marine Corps was a little bit odd, and actually spins back into how I started Alpha Architect. So I actually was in a PhD program before I was in decided to do my time in the service there. So I went to Chicago PhD programs 2002, did 2 years there, and then in those programs, you basically get hazed your first 2 years, and then you have to take these things called your comps. And at that point, you're kind of done with the formal schoolwork, and now you move to what they call ABD, or all but dissertation phase. And so I'd spent 2 years in that PhD program there, you know, doing finance and math, you know, 15, 16 hours a day, kind of passed all the tests. And you know, for me, I just wanted to, I don't know if I'd say take a break, but just, you know, do something different because I was a little bit younger. So I basically joined the Marine Corps, did that for 4 years, and then came back.
Were your advisors and were your family, were they like, you are crazy, or what was their reaction? Because I can't imagine a lot of people have done that before.
You'd be surprised. There's actually a lot of military personnel in the PhD program there. A lot of times, like IDF, like Israeli dudes and everything. Just because I think they probably want to, you know, get super disciplined, motivated people because they can actually make it through, you know, the PhD program. So it was actually interesting when I, you know, had all this chatter about, you know, doing my time, you know, half the PhD program are like, yeah, of course you would do that. Why wouldn't you be in the service? people are like, well, that's weird. But in Chicago PhD program at that time, there was just a lot of Israeli folks in there. Obviously, like, my mom was pissed off because they don't ever want their babies to go, you know, in the service, but I think she understood. My girlfriend / you know, ended up being my wife, she was like, you're insane, but she also knew me, so she kind of wasn't too surprised. And then when I talked to my advisors, both of which are Nobel Prize winners now, like Dick Thaler was one of my advisors at the time, and then Eugene Fama as well. Fama, I don't know if you know, or your listeners probably don't know him, but he's kind of a short, wiry Italian guy who's super hardcore, you know, shows up to work every day at, you know, 5, 6 a.m. and just grinds, even though he's, you know, super famous and probably has better things to do. And so I told him about it. He's like, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, where do I sign the paperwork? And, you know, great, go for it. So kind of like, you know, like, cool, yeah, all good, I support you. And then, you know, Dick Thaler, who just actually won the Nobel Prize as well for behavioral finance, basically, which is just kind of saying that, you know, humans are crazy and, you know, screw things up all the time. he had obviously a much different reaction. He's like, what the hell are you talking about? This is insane. But then after I kind of said, hey, you know, no, I'm actually serious. He's like, all right, yeah, I mean, I'll support you. That's cool. Where do I sign? And, you know, all good. So kind of a mixed bag of reaction, I'd say.
Mm. That's awesome. And so you you kind of like take a break from the PhD process and you go into the Marines from there.
Yeah, basically, typically they give you a 1 year sabbatical. So I had to apply, you know, that's why I had to get all the paperwork signed to do a 4 year one. And actually the good thing is the PhD director at the time, her husband was actually a Navy guy who actually retired. So he spent his 20 years in, so she kind of was, you know, amiable the whole service thing. But yeah, did my 4 years, and then, you know, showed back up to the program and re-enrolled, and, you know, had to basically kind of relearn, you know, everything, and even my own papers I couldn't even understand. But, you know, it's kind of like, what do they say, riding a bike, you know? you may forget, but when you get back on, you figure it out real quick. So, yeah, I just started doing research and, you know, just grinding every day to graduate from that place.
That's wild. And did you I guess before you started the PhD process, did you know eventually you wanted to start your own fund, or when did that idea come about?
Yeah, I had always been wanting to start my own business, specifically like an asset management firm, like since I was a little kid. Don't ask me why. I was always into like Warren Buffett. My late grandmother was into it as well, and had me reading, you know, like Buffettology and Ben Graham books when I was like 12. So I don't know. I just always like just liked finance stuff for some reason. And I always knew I wanted to, you know, run like asset management business, cause I just thought it was cool and interesting. It's just a matter of like, how the heck do you know, get people to give you money to manage and get paid for it is, you know, easier said than done. So it took me a long time to get there, but I figured, hey, I'll just try to get really smart and, you know, learn as much as I can about this subject. And then, you know, hopefully luck and circumstance, will put me in a position where, you know, I can, you know, make something happen. And that's obviously what ended up, you know, occurring. But, you know, my original plan was when I was 18 to have Warren Buffett call me up, give me $1 billion, and, you know, be retired when I was 20, but it didn't work that way.
That didn't pan out. Well, there's still time on that one.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. that was the hope and the dream, but that never panned out as planned.
You know, for someone listening, let's say they're on active duty and they, you know, probably have an understanding that there is an industry that is finance related, but they probably don't know what an asset management firm is. How would you explain, like, what is an asset management firm?
Well, it depends who you ask. Obviously, I can just tell you what kind of we do. So, so our job is, in many respects, it's kind of like being in the service, or, you know, specifically like me, like in the Marines, where, you know, essentially we leverage processes and systems to basically accomplish a mission, where our mission is to try to, you know, go build an algorithm or a system or an SOP, like standard operating procedure, try to figure out how to pick stocks or bonds or whatever that, you know, hopefully, you know, generate some returns that are better than just throwing darts at the wall. You know, so maybe example, just because I got a military audience here, is, you know, take me back here, because it's been about a decade since I was in the service, but I do remember like thing like SAFE, where you were ever put in like a defense position, you follow this SOP, you know, first you lay in security, next you put down automatic weapons like your, you know, 240s, what have you. You know, they do fields of fire, interlocking fires, and then you entrench. And what's the point of this? And why does every single Marine, you know, follow this model? Well, because this is tried and true. It works. It's, you know, burned with blood, lesson learned. You know, same thing what we do in the securities markets is we say, hey, we're going to identify SOPs. So, for example, we have like a systematic, quote-unquote, value algorithm. And what's it do? It buys cheap stocks. And these cheap stocks have indications of good fundamental quality. And we just follow that SOP. Just like a Marine, if he's getting shot at, laying in a defense position, you follow the SAFE SOP. We kind of have the same viewpoint. We just follow operating procedures that we think make sense and are, you know, tried and true. And we use those to try to, you know, make money basically in stock markets effectively.
And what was your... how would you explain like what your focus was for your PhD, and like how did it relate to helping you figure out how to do that?
Well, so I mean, writing a PhD is a lot of times a lot different than you know, practical world. That's why they call it the ivory tower. Mm-hmm. So from in my situation, I had kind of one part. It was a theory paper, just trying to understand why, you know, smart people, specifically smart investors, would ever share information with one another. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, for a lot of people, it's like, well, of course you share information with your friends to kind of learn stuff, what have you. But in financial markets is actually a puzzle. Why would you ever find like a really smart stock picker who would share that information with his friends, because he wants to kind of hoard that for himself? So I wrote a whole theory about, you know, basically why people do that. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons for it, but essentially people like to share good ideas with other smart people, because sometimes that other smart person may give you an insight that you didn't even think about. And as long as it's kind of a quid pro quo, you know, it could be a win-win. So anyways, that was like the theory. But then there happened to be a organization called, which is still exists to this day, called Value Investors Club. It's basically a fancy message board for, you know, hedge fund managers and, you know, sophisticated stock pickers, where they would basically submit, you know, pretty complex pitches on different stock ideas, like a, you know, a 10-page article on why, you know, Disney's undervalued. It would initially be shared just with the internal members of this club. I think it was at the time it was maxed at around 250. So it was kind of like an awesome, you know, a little research lab where I could say, hey, this is a scenario where there's all these great ideas being posted to this message board that are kind of private and shared amongst this select group of people that keep sharing good ideas with one another. That's one, not predicted by any economic theory that I know of. And two, this is just interesting in its own right. And I end up reading literally at every single, you know, stock pick that they ever submitted this deal, like 3,000 or 4,000 of them. And I just cataloged them in a database and, you know, did all this work to try to ascertain, like, hey, are these ideas they're sharing, you know, actually good? Like, do they quote unquote beat the market? And it turned out they did. So I guess that helped me now, because I, you know, read every stock pitch on the planet Earth for about 10 years. So I kind of, you know, heard it all and saw it all at some point. So that was kind of useful. But it was mainly just the intellectual, you know, PhD exercise more than anything. It's not 100% applicable to what we, you know, what we do in our business now. But at the margin, it might be.
And so how did you go from, you know, getting a PhD to starting a fund? Like, how does one go about starting their own asset management firm?
Well, typically, you got to be born into a lot of money. That's the easiest methodology. unfortunately, that was not me. I was not part of the guy that helped us out. They call it the Lucky Sperm Club. I was not in that club, unfortunately. So I guess I had to do it the old-fashioned way, which is get lucky, and that's exactly what happened. So what I had always been big about, you know, just doing techniques to try to discipline yourself to actually do the work. And, you know, for me, it was all about reading source journal literature in academic, you know, finance journals. And, you know, you can sit there and say, oh, I'm going to go read one article a day, but unless there's some, you know, mechanism to force you to do that, you won't do it. So I used to have a blog, and I still do, where I would just write about, you know, geeky papers, you know, way back in the day, not really expect anyone to actually read this stuff, but, you know, it's just, for me, it was a great way to force myself to, you know, actually read the article and try to understand it. So I set that up, and then I actually went on the academic job market. So I was, you know, basically going to be a professor, which I went on that market, and that's exactly what happened. But the exact same time that I was basically getting my academic job, I literally got cold called by a billionaire, this guy named Eddie Stern, they're part of a huge real estate family in New York. And they were just transitioning out of the 08 crisis, and they're like, you know what, we're getting rid of all these damn hedge fund managers. Like, we got to control our own money. We got to control our own taxes. We got to lower cost. We want to go quant, and we need someone to help us out here. And he's like, I've been reading your blog. you're the guy I want to talk to. I was like, all right, this is cool. A billionaire's calling me. And so we kind of hit it off. We basically started consulting for those guys while I was kind of starting up also as a professor. And, you know, we just worked with them for a couple of years. And the guy that was assigned to me actually as my research assistant when I started my professor job at Drexel was this guy named Jack Vogel, who's currently, you know, one of my business partners. And it's just convenient that you know, we got along really well. We've been doing research since the very beginning, and we kind of were doing this kind of consulting thing on the side. And then I told Eddie, I was like, hey man, I was like, if we do a really good job, like, you know, you got tons of money. If we whip it on for you, you know, could you give us a shot, you know, at the asset management business? I don't really want to be a consultant my whole life, you know, which is cool, but that's just not what I always wanted to do. And he's like, yeah, we'll see how it works out. So basically worked for those guys. And then 2012, they gave us 20 mil in the managed account, and that quickly ramped up to 50, which obviously gave us the kind of, you know, capital base to, you know, get the popsicle stand going. And that's what we did. And then we just kept doing what we'd always done. We just did research, you know, did blogs, did education, and then somehow, some way, people just would find us and reach out, and they'd say, hey, well, you know, I read your stuff. This seems cool. How do I do it? And yes, we just built the business that way, kind of inbound marketing, I guess you'd call it.
I love that your 20-year-old self or 18-year-old self had that vision of Warren Buffett calling you up and offering your job, and you were right about the billionaire calling you and giving your job. You just had the wrong billionaire. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I had the wrong billionaire, and it was about 20 years or 15 years later, and they didn't just give us the money. took a lot more time and effort, but hey, you know, I was hoping for good things in my early days. I was a little bit more naive.
I love this thought of recognizing it's going to be difficult to do research just independently, and so starting the blog and having that, it sounds like it's a catalyst for you to you know, routinely be doing research and writing and sharing. And it's incredible that from that, you know, you're sharpening your skills, but you're also starting to get an audience, and that leads to some incredible people coming to you and bringing opportunities that would probably never have come your way if they didn't see that blog because you were posting so often. That's just a really incredible.
I think 100%, and obviously it was good timing because we kind of hit it right when blogs weren't that cool, but we just happened to be doing it anyways, and the internet's taken over. And I think, I mean, that basically what we're talking about here is distribution, and normally you can't get into asset management or the finance business unless you have distribution, which means you're at Wall Street at a bank. But the internet has kind of disrupted all businesses where you don't need an intermediary distribution agent anymore. You can go direct consumer because people can go on Google and find you. Yep. And so to the extent you're writing good content, you know, being genuine, being authentic and trying to add value, you know, nowadays people will find you. So we just got lucky that we were able to scale without literally any sales. Like we don't have salespeople, which is absurd for a finance business. People are like, what, you don't have distribution? We're like, no, we just do what we want every day and write blogs and, you know, talk about research, and that is our distribution apparently.
And that's one of the things I wanted to ask about. I've gotten feedback from our listeners. One of the things they really like hearing about is just understanding what each person's day-to-day life looks like. And I'm wondering, could you just kind of walk us through a hypothetical day, like what time you get to the office, what sort of things you're doing throughout the day?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, I mean, my stuff is very odd and totally unique and insane and not normal. Just to preface this. So I actually am kind of a productivity efficiency, anal retentive person. So I actually built an office in my house, because I hate commuting. We also have a gym here, like a CrossFit gym. So I've tried to build my life around, you know, maximizing time where I can still hang out with my family and do that stuff, but also maximize my opportunity to work and get stuff done. So I'm literally here in my, I guess, compound all the time, which again is a little bit not standard, especially for like a finance business. But I get up early, like 6 o'clock, start grinding because it's my, you know, 2-3 hours before everyone kind of where I can just focus and write and think about stuff. And if you're usually like trading guy, like we have, you know, 7-8 guys that come in every day. And then, you know, once the day starts, I'm usually getting, you know, pulled here or there to, you know, put out fires or whatever. We grind till about, I don't know, 4:35. And then, you know, we do PT, you know, just like in the military. So we'll go haze ourselves, run laps around the blocks, do kettlebells, what have you. And I come in, and I usually keep grinding till around, you know, 6:30. And then my wife will start yelling at me, and then go eat dinner, hang out with the kids, put them to bed. And then I usually grind from, you know, 8:30 to 10, and then just do that every day. it's just grind, dude, every day, put my time in. It's not really... It's not that glamorous, to be honest.
Do you end up working the weekends, or are you able to unplug on the weekends?
Usually I work on the weekends. You know, I try to be cognizant of, you know, mindfulness and trying to clear my brain.
Yep.
So, and I usually just do that through PT. So I'll just, you know, go haze myself. And I'm in like an old guy's soccer game. And I do try to unplug as best I can, but obviously, you know, we're entrepreneurial, and there's, you know, I'm kind of the guy in charge of things. So I gotta, you know, if there's something to be done, yeah, I gotta kind of do it. So it's, yeah, I usually don't get weekends totally off, but sometimes I do, and try my best to, you know, minimize that, but, you know, it just is what it is sometimes.
And I'm trying to get my head around this compound. So is this like a big, like, warehouse of which part of it is kind of your living area and part of it's like the team offices?
It's really hard to explain unless you've been here. And on Twitter, you know, it's actually kind of becoming a legend in the sense that when you come here, you get a picture. We have a grizzly bear in the office, and I post it. But essentially, I got this place from a guy. He had terminal cancer, and it was kind of a weird fixer-upper thing. He was a former really famous big-game hunter. So it's this house. It was like 2,500 square foot, and he built this huge trophy room. It's like 1,600 square foot extension. It's just like a big, like, hall you'd see in, like, I guess an Aspen, you know, lodge or something, but it's in the middle of the suburbs in Broomall, Pennsylvania. And then he also built a man cave, about 1,500 square foot. So when I saw this joint, I got thinking. I was like, all right, this is a value investment, because, you know, it's kind of chaotic. I was like, you know, I could do something with this. So we basically turned the man cave into an office. We kind of turned the, you know, the great room, trophy room, and kind of a, you know, conference area, hangout area, you know, just basically like a massive room to just, you know, host things. And then there's actual house here too. Yeah. And so it worked out perfect. So it's got like a pretty big driveway. And then we have another structure, backyard, that used to be a kind of a garage for all his landscaping stuff, like equipment. And we just blew all that out and put like a bunch of gym stuff in there. So yeah, I mean, you'd have to show up. We also have a bunch of legacy taxidermy. So we got like a leopard, you know, a few like bighorn sheep, a grizz. We got I guess you have to just be here to get a good sense of, you know, the situation. It's, like I said, very, very non-standard.
And you know, that time, I'm thinking particularly before the rest of the office crew shows up, that peaceful time in the morning when you have a little bit of time to yourself, what is that like? Are you just like, you're just reading everything you can and just learning and writing and thinking? I picture you as kind of the king of the cocktail party. You're just constantly taking in information and knowing everything about everything. Is there a better way to describe it to listeners?
Yeah. So what I do is I usually in the morning, you know, I've kind of pruned down my information flow where I have a lot of sources and I just keep tabs on like things I want to look at.
Yep.
And it's usually just, you know, academic papers. So and I've gotten, having been doing this for so many years, I've gotten super efficient at kind of, you know, screening out the bullshit, I guess would be the French term for it. I just get down to the meat and potatoes of like, hey, these three or four articles kind of interesting. I dig a little bit deeper, and then to the extent that I think it, you know, has a useful insight or something that maybe other investors would be interested in, you know, I'll just, you know, write a summary or write a blog post on it. And more and more, to be honest, though, because we've gotten such a huge platform, like I've actually kind of moved more towards even like an editorial role where we've got so many guest writers now and content from my team. It's a full-time job just, you know, figuring out what to write about, reviewing other people's stuff, sending back feedback so they can send it back to me. So I do a lot of that as well, just almost like, you know, it's like running a newspaper, I guess, at some level. But another part of my role is just being an editor, I guess, of the blog.
You know, given the other veterans you know, I'm just curious, like, what's your thoughts on why someone listening to the show may love a career like this? And what are some indications that they may really not like this sort of career?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the entrepreneurial career. So, you know, to the extent you like challenges, you're good at just grinding it out, and you know, you can take a lot of pain and you never give up. It's a great thing. And obviously, you know, no pain, no gain, you know, so there's a lot of like pain and anguish, but to the extent you love challenges, you know, I recommend it for anybody. The other downside of it is that there is no, like in the military, kind of you get told what to do at level. You know, obviously in our situation, you figure out what to do. There is no boss. Like I don't have a boss or anyone like tells me what to do every day. You literally got to figure it out. So it's very like free form and, you know, creative, and you're always, you know, trying to come up with new ideas. But for some people that's, you know, extremely nerve wracking because, you know, it's stressful, chaotic, your cortisol starts spiking. But to the extent you like that, you know, I think it's great. Now, finance industry specifically, not to be a Debbie Downer, but this business is adapting and changing very dramatically where, you know, if you don't have scale, you don't have a very niche kind of uber specialized skill set, it's hard to compete, frankly. Like the days of, you know, throwing up a plaque and saying, hey, I'm going to start up a hedge fund, charge 2 and 20, and, you know, someone will give you money, you know, it's just numbered. So our specific industry, unless you got a very niche skill set or you can really grind hard for a long, long time, you know, I'd say vets probably have better opportunities in things like, yeah, I know a lot of guys like in operating companies like oil, gas, or going to go run like a PE turnaround, things like that where, you know, military skill sets are much more transferable. But, you know, obviously running like quant finance models is not exactly a, you know, a typical skill set that, you know, most military veterans have. I was kind of unique. So, yeah, I mean, it's a tough business to be in right now. So I would think tread lightly if you wanted to get into the asset manager business, unless you really knew what you were getting into as a veteran.
What was that like, seeing that Wall Street Journal article? I mean, that's gotta be pretty crazy to get such great, incredible recognition.
You know, man, I always tell people I'd rather be rich than famous. But apparently I just got to be famous to get rich. And, you know, at this point I've been on every podcast. I've been on the cover of Barron's, Wall Street Journal. We had a big spread in New York Times.
Call recording off.
Just don't really, I don't let it go to my head, which, you know, I still, you know, I got three kids and I wipe shitty diapers up and I wake up at 6 and grind every day like every other guy. So I don't feel like I'm that special, and, you know, it just is what it is. Like, you know, it's just, I got a story, but everyone's got a story, and, you know, I got lucky that mine was on Wall Street Journal and others aren't, but it doesn't really affect me. I don't really think about it that much, to be honest.
How has life changed? I guess, you know, you've been at this 7+ years. You've got a team of 15 or so around you now. How is your day-to-day life different now than in that first year when you were just getting things off the ground?
You know, it's really not. We're still in the same offices. You know, we have better computers, and you know, we obviously are making some money now. We used to just light it on fire. So that's obviously a little bit nicer. But we have a philosophy of like what we call being a cockroach entrepreneur again, because a lot of your viewers and listeners probably don't maybe know our business, so I'll give a little context. But there's this firm called Vanguard in our business, and they're like the 800-pound gorilla, you know, just destroying everyone. And if you're not competing at like the razor's edge, you're dead. Well, they happen to be 10 minutes up the road from here, and this whole community, I'm surrounded by those folks. So, you know, I kind of know where the 800-pound gorilla is, and I know how they act and operate and what I got to do to win. And it involves just being a cockroach. So, you know, being living way under your means, doing more with less, being in a shitty office, you know, just grinding every day. So, and that philosophy, honestly, it hasn't really changed. Like, we don't really do anything different than we did, you know, when we started this popsicle stand 7-8 years ago. We just, you know, have nicer gear and, you know, more folks around to, you know, help me get things done where I'm not, you know, doing compliance, doing trading and, you know, doing everything. That now I got people and teammates that can help me, you know, accomplish a mission a little more efficiently. But I mean, honestly, we just keep doing the same thing, just grind it out and, you know, work hard every day.
That's awesome, man. I just respect that too. I imagine having the enemy around the corner is like motivating because it causes you to push yourself more. But I love that thought of not resting on your laurels and just kind of the things that made you successful to get here are the things that are going to keep you successful to get further. And it's awesome to think of just not stepping back and coasting, but just continuing to push with everything you've got.
Yeah, well, there's I'll never forget, but I was deployed in Haditha, which is out in Alambar province in 2006, and I had to go hang out in this place called Barwana and at the patrol base there. Like, I used to be with the Iraqi dudes, but we happened to be hanging out with Marines this time. And I remember in Barwana, in that base camp there was this huge, like, mortar shell that had smashed the side of a wall out, and under it, in, like, red letters said, complacency kills. And the idea was, you know, every time you go on a patrol outside the wire, you know, just always remember that the minute you think you've won, you know, everyone else is reacting and the enemy's thinking, you know, if you think you won, you're dead. And so we, you know, I just kind of think that's a good attitude to have in business. And we're just lucky and frankly blessed that the number one competitor in our entire industry just is in our backyard. So every single day, you know, I'm looking down a bazooka and I know, you know, if we think we want anything, we're going to get destroyed. So we just have the luck of having availability bias every day and, you know, having to, you know, deal with them in our backyard, which is, you know, blessing and a curse, I guess.
That's awesome. What about for a veteran who's listening, who, you know, a lot of what you're saying resonates, but they're not looking to start their own firm? Is there any advice on kind of career paths that might have someone join an asset management firm, you know, without necessarily starting their own?
Yeah, there's a few of them. I mean, again, the problem with the business is it's getting so computerized and automated. Like, I mean, we manage almost $800 million right now, and there's really only, you know, 7 of us that are full-time, and then the rest are like 1099s and contractors and, you know, people that are bolted on. But, you know, so you just don't need humans anymore. What you need is humans that know how to program computers in our business, and more, you know, you got to be really careful about the path you pick, because you may put a ton of time and effort in our industry and realize there's, you know, whatever, 5 jobs for everyone across the whole board. It's just a bad trend. So what I say is, if you want to get into like what we're doing, asset management kind of in, you know, systematic quant kind of bigger scale versus, you know, say like a 2 in 20 uber niche like hedge fund business, you've got to be extremely tech savvy. So if you can get programming skills, technical skills, and just be super knowledgeable about markets, that's obviously one route. And you got to be really good at that. Another route, and frankly, it's one that I think veterans are probably well suited for, is in the end, no matter how smart you are, how many computers you got or what have you, the bottom line of asset management is you got to get money and convince people to invest with you. And one of the things I think veterans have just from dealing with all walks of life and all kinds of problems is they have very high emotional IQ or kind of this ability to, you know, interact and you know, work with people and gain their trust and have integrity and all that good stuff. And I think that's a key element of fundraising. So in fundraising capability is something that all asset managers for all time will always pay huge dollars for. So to the extent that you feel like you have high emotional IQ, you know, you feel like you're good at building relationships, you're smart enough to kind of understand what's going on, and you can communicate that to folks that, you know, maybe don't have PhDs in finance or engineering or what have you, I think anything like that is a way to make a lot of money down the road. And it's something where I think veterans can kind of weave their way through along a career path to get there. They basically become a fundraiser.
It's like a, you know, it's like a dual-edged sword, because I think, you know, just from other interviews, it's like, I think veterans, like you said, they're trustworthy. They have huge, you know, emotional intelligence, and they've got that relatability. And it seems like one of the most difficult things for veterans to get their head around is how to sell without feeling slimy, how to make those relationships without, like, or how to approach networking without feeling sleazy about it. And so it's like, I agree with what you're saying. It's just like, if the listener, you know, can reconcile a way of selling that's authentic for them, I think that they bring a lot of assets to bear in that fundraising mindset.
Definitely. And what I recommend is for people, because, you know, I'm like that. A lot of people are like that. Like, I hate selling unless I'm selling something that I am passionate about and I love and I do with my own money and everything. Then it's not selling. It's just spreading the gospel. Yeah. So I think to the extent that you can find a firm, or you find a culture where it motivates you to show up every day and you're actually excited about the mission. Like our firm mission is empower investors for education. So to the extent that you like helping people out, you like educating, you know, you could be selling them freaking ice cubes, but who cares? As long as you got that passion for that mission to, like, help people out and better understand markets, you know, it's not selling. It's, you know, it's what you like to do. And then you can kind of get around this whole feeling slimy thing, which, you know, I agree with. Like, if you ask me, like, hey, go sell insurance for Prudential, I'd be like, well, how about I go hang from the rafters instead? you know, it's just not going to turn me on. But, you know, but if it's something I like, then I'm all in, man. Yep. And I think, you know, veterans are the same way. So they've got to really find something they really believe in. Yep. If they're not going to create the product or the service themselves, just, you know, attach to a star and then sell that. And believe in it and learn about it, and you'll be all good.
I always like to leave listeners with resources, you know, something that even if they're on a ship right now, maybe they're pulling into a port next week, something that they could pick up, maybe a book or a podcast or a program, or just something that you think, you know, has helped you in your career that might help them if they're interested in this path. Is there any book or resource you would recommend to them?
Sure. I got a laundry list from simple to complex. Probably, I think blogs are probably the best and podcasts. So at the simple end, there's a blog called wealthofcommonsense.com. It's done by a friend of mine named Ben Carlson, and he does do some complex things, but he's very good at just doing basic ideas in finance and investing and communicating it in a way that I think is easy for people to understand. And then on the other spectrum is probably like, you know, our blog at Alpha Architect, where it's, you know, it's more geeky, but to the extent you want to learn the research and you want to get in the weeds, I mean, that's literally the whole mission of our website, is to help people that want to be investors do that. But it is at another level. And as far as pods, you know, Pat O'Shaughnessy's got a great podcast called Best with the Best, I think. Meb Faber's got a great podcast. There's the Investors podcast by Preston and Stig. Preston's actually an Army veteran. So those are all good. And then also just get on Twitter. Like, Twitter's like a poor resource in many aspects of life, but in finance specifically, there's a great community of kind of young, you know, up-and-coming folks that are in the business, and they're very helpful, and, you know, it's very win-win versus kind of dog-eat-dog mentality. So just get on Twitter and start following people that you like and are interesting. You know, Josh Brown's a good one, the foreign broker. And I think that right there will get you started on your way.
That's awesome. Well, I always like to leave the last word for my guest. And, you know, I just ask, we've covered so many different topics that I think will be helpful to listeners, but I always like to turn it over to you for some final words of wisdom. If there's anything we haven't covered that you want to share with listeners, I'll pass the mic over to you.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any special advice except, you know, grind every day and work hard. The one thing I would say, just from being around a lot of people in our business, which tends to kind of smoke people out a lot because they work 100-hour weeks and go crazy, is, you know, if you're not eating right, if you're not sleeping right, and if you're not doing your PT, you know, you're not keeping your machine finely tuned, you know, your mind ain't going to work and just your life's going to suck. So I think just always find time to, you know, eat well. You know, if you can, try to get your 7-8 hours of sleep and always try to get your PT in. Just because I think that'll keep you efficient, keep your mind clear, and, you know, it's all about fundamentals, you know, shoot, move, communicate. You know, that's all the military's all about. Well, life's all about, you know, eating, sleeping, and PTing, and working, and having fun. It's really not that complicated. So, you know, just focus on the fundamentals, you'll probably be all right.
Yeah, this is awesome. Well, Wes, I appreciate your taking time out of the busy schedule at the compound and taking a break from researching and all that you do to share this words of wisdom with the Beyond the Informed community. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, you got it, Justin. Appreciate it, and thank you for doing what you do. I think it's you know, a great podcast, and I actually am a huge fan and listener myself, so keep up the good work.
Surface.
So last year, I've done it 2 years in a row, but there's this this 28-mile ruck march hosted by the Pennsylvania National Guard. It's called March of the Fallen. And the idea is you're out there just hustling and working hard to just, you know, be thankful that you can still feel pain, you know, because obviously a lot of people don't anymore. It's a great event. It's not about money at all. It's like $30. But you're out there in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of PA, and what I do, or at least what we did last year, what I'm going to do again next year, is I get a bunch of barracks up there, and we host like a, you know, fairly large group of, you know, big money people, movers and shakers, and, you know, just people that are, you know, just good folks that are great for networking and trying to do good things in society, and we're all out there, you know, sweating together with the, you know, the billionaires and the millionaires and the, you know, broke plumbers that don't have a job, but we're all in it to win it. And it's, you know, great event. It's next September. If you just follow our blog, or shoot me an email, I'll put you on my list. But it's just great opportunity for vets that are out of the service or even in the service, kind of reconnect to your roots and, you know, just, you know, kind of honor the fallen basically.
That's so awesome.
Yeah,
I will.
I'll
add more info on the show notes for listeners on that too. Definitely check that out next September 2018. It sounds like an incredible event.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun, and we did it this last year, and a lot of people, especially if you're not from like a military culture, you know, I think it was very moving for them because they're like, "Holy cow! Like, this is real," you know, because you got Gold Star families out there. And so I think if you got like civilian buddies who are, you know, just into PT and into doing right, you know, it's a great thing to invite them to because it's a much more moving event for them even than for service members because we're kind of used to that whole thing. But for civilians, like pure civilians, it's, you know, it's a very, you know, moving event and I think a good thing for them.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did. I am fired up. That is like a couple of cups of coffee, some jet fuel to get you going. Listening to someone like Wes, it is no surprise why he has succeeded. And you see that grit and determination and surprisingly the humility that comes through. But I think one of the things I liked most about this interview was that thought of grinding. The quote that I had written down from our interview was, "I don't have any special advice besides grind every day and work hard. If you're not eating right, sleeping right, and doing your PT, keeping your machine finely tuned, your mind isn't going to work and your life is going to suck." That resonates with me. When I first started Storybox, I was working 24/7 and sleeping hardly at all and eating out of control and put on 20 pounds and was just clearly grinding gears and not operating at my peak. And it took me a while to realize that you really have to take care of your physical and mental health in order to operate at your peak potential. So I love that that piece of knowledge that Wes shared. Definitely check out the show notes for this at beyondtheuniform.io. I love all the different resources he recommended and how he breaks them down from simple to complex. All of those are in the show notes. And I love this other thought. I love that story that he shared about complacency kills. It's such a strong visual, but whether you're in finance or still on active duty or whatever you're thinking of doing in your civilian career, I think that's a lesson that's that is very, very powerful. That, if you think that you've won, you're dead, is how he put it. I thought that was just great. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes, you'll find the director of resources, you'll find events. Definitely sign up, pre-register for that veterans and consulting class, as well as the new reprogramming seminar. Lots of exciting information coming there, so make sure on that newsletter list. And if you haven't yet had a chance to give us a 5-star rating, or 6 if that's what it is, I think it's out of 5, but 5 or 6 or 7 stars, however many stars Apple will let you get away with, would love a positive review in addition to letting me point to that to my grandmother and make her feel proud of me. It does get this word out about the show to other veterans who can benefit from stories like Wes's. Other than that, have a fantastic week, and I look forward to seeing you on the next interview.